It would help if you were a bit more robust. Oh, but I guess we'll have to make do with what we have. Go get your things, Sinedra. From now on, you will be staying with me. I think I'm going to want to keep an eye on you. In the weeks that followed, they moved down through the moist green Arendish forest, and word of their coming spread throughout Asturia. Sinedra was dimly aware that Polgara was carefully controlling the size and composition of the audiences to be addressed. Poor Lulderan was seldom out of his saddle as he and a carefully selected group of his friends ranged ahead of the advancing army to prepare each gathering. Sinedra, once she had finally accepted her duty, had assumed that speaking in public would grow easier with practice. Unfortunately, she was wrong. Panic still gripped her before each speech, and quite frequently she was physically sick. Although Polgara assured her that her speeches were getting better, Sinedra complained that they were not getting easier. The drain on her physical and emotional reserves became more and more evident. Like most girls her age, Sinedra could, and often did, talk endlessly, but her orations were not random talk. They required an enormous control and a tremendous expenditure of emotional energy, and no one could help her. As the crowds grew larger, however, Polgara did provide some aid in a purely technical matter. "Just speak in a normal tone of voice, Sinedra," she instructed. "Don't exhaust yourself by trying to shout. I will see to it that everybody can hear you." Aside from that, however, the princess was on her own, and the strain became more and more visible. She rode listlessly at the head of her growing army, seeming sometimes almost to be in a trance. Her friends watched her and worried.
"I'm not sure how much longer she can keep up this pace," King Folrek confided to King Rodar, as they rode directly behind the drooping little queen toward the ruins of Vovachun, where she was to address yet another gathering. "I think we tend sometimes to forget how small and delicate she is."
"Maybe we had better consult with Polgara," King Rodar agreed. "I think the child needs a week to rest."
Sinedra, however, knew that she could not stop. There was a momentum to this, a kind of accelerating rhythm that could not be broken. At first, word of her coming had spread slowly, but now it ran ahead of them, and she knew they must run faster and faster to keep up with it. There was a crucial point at which the curiosity about her must be satisfied, or the whole thing would collapse and she would have to begin all over again. The crowd at Vovachun was the largest she had yet addressed. Half convinced already, they needed only a single spark to ignite them. Once again sick with unreasoning panic, the Raven Queen gathered her strength and rose to address them, and to set them aflame with her call to war. When it was over, and the young nobles had been gathered into the growing ranks of the army, Sinedra sought a few moments of solitude on the outskirts of the camp to compose herself. This had become a kind of necessary ritual for her. Sometimes she was sick after a speech, and sometimes she wept. Sometimes she merely wandered listlessly, not even seeing the trees about her. At Polgara's instruction, Durnik always accompanied her, and Sinedra found the company of this solid, practical man strangely comforting. They had walked some distance from the ruins. The afternoon was bright and sunny, and birds were singing among the trees. Pensively, Sinedra walked, letting the peace of the forest quiet the agitated turmoil within her.
"It's all very well for Nobleman Detton," she heard someone say somewhere on the other side of a thicket. "But what does it have to do with us?"
"You're probably right, Lamo," a second voice agreed with a regretful sigh.
"Well, it was very stirring, though, wasn't it?" "The only thing that ought to be a stirring thing to a serf is the sight of something to eat. The little girl can talk all she wants about duty. My only duty is to my stomach." He stopped abruptly.
"Are the leaves of that plant over there fit to eat?"
"I think they are poisonous, Lamor," Detton replied.
"But you are not sure. I would hate to pass up something
that I could eat if there was any chance that it would not kill me. Tenedra listened to the two serfs with growing horror. Could anybody be reduced to that level? Impulsively, she stepped around the thicket to confront them. Dernick, as always, stayed close by her side. The two serfs were dressed in mud-spattered rags. They were both men of middle years, and there was no evidence on their faces that either of them had ever known a happy day. The leaner of the two was closely examining a thick-leafed weed, but the other saw Senedra approaching and started with obvious fright.
"La mère,"
he gasped.
"It is her, the one who spoke today."
La mère straightened, his gaunt face going pale beneath the dirt that smudged it.
Your ladyship,"
he said, grotesquely trying to bow.
"We were just on our way back to our villages. We didn't know this part of the forest was yours. We didn't take anything."
He held out his empty hands as if to prove his words.
"How long has it been since you have had anything to eat?"
"Oh, well, I ate some grass this morning, your ladyship. And I had a couple of turnips yesterday. Yes, they were a little wormy, but not so bad."
Senedra's eyes suddenly filled with tears.
"Who has done this to you?"
Lemmer looked a little confused at her question. Finally, he shrugged slightly.
"Ah, the world, I guess, your ladyship. A certain part of what we raise goes to our lord, and a certain part to his lord. And then there is the part that has to go to the king, and the part that has to go to the royal governor, and we're still paying for some wars my lord had a few years ago. After all of that has been paid, well, there's not very much left for us."
A horrible thought struck her.
"I'm gathering an army for a campaign in the east," she told them.
"Yes, your ladyship,"
the other serf replied.
"We heard your speech today."
"What will you two do?"
Detton shrugged.
"It will mean more taxes, your ladyship. And some of our sons will be taken for soldiers, if our lords decide to join you. Serfs don't really make very good soldiers, but they can always carry the baggage, and when the time comes to storm my castle, the nobility seem to want to have a lot of serfs around to help with the dying."
"Then you never feel any patriotism when you go to war?"
"What could patriotism have to do with serfs, my lady? Until a month or so ago, I didn't even know the name of my country. None of it belongs to me. Why should I have any feelings about it?"
Tenedra could not answer that question. Their lives were so bleak, so hopelessly empty, and her call to war meant only greater hardship and more suffering for them.
"What about your families? If Torak wins, the Grolums will come and slaughter your families on his altars."
"I have no family, my lady," Emma replied in a dead voice. "My son died several years ago. My lord was fighting a war somewhere, and when they attacked a castle, the people inside poured boiling pitch down on the serfs who were trying to raise a ladder. My wife starved herself to death after she heard about it. The Grolums cannot hurt either one of them now. And if they want to kill me, they are welcome to."
"Isn't there anything at all that you would be willing to fight for?"
"Food, I suppose," Lemmer said after a moment's thought. "I am very tired of being hungry."
Tenedra turned to the other serf.
"What about you?"
"I'd walk into a fire for somebody who would feed me,"
Detton replied fervently.
"Come with me,"
Tenedra commanded them, and she turned and led the way back to the camp and the large, bulky supply wagons that had transported the vast quantities of food from the storehouses of Sindaria.
"I want these two men fed,"
she told a startled cook.
"As much as they can eat."
Dernick, however, his honest eyes brimming with compassion, had already reached into one of the wagons and taken out a large loaf of bread. He tore it in two and gave half to Lemmer, and half to Detton. Lemaire stared at the chunk of bread in his hands, trembling violently.
"I will follow you, my lady,"
he declared in a quavering voice.
"I have eaten my shoes, lived on boiled grass and tree roots."
His fists closed about the chunk of bread, as if he were afraid someone might take it away from him.
"I will follow you to the end of the world and back for this."
And he began to eat, tearing at the bread with his teeth. Tenedra stared at him and then suddenly fled. By the time she reached her tent, she was weeping hysterically. Edera and Taiba tried without success to comfort her, and finally they sent for Polgara. When the sorceress arrived, she took one brief look and asked Taiba and Edera to leave her alone with the sobbing girl.
"All right, Tenedra," she said calmly, sitting on the bed and gathering the princess in her arms. "What is this all about?"
"I cannot do this anymore, Lady Polgara. I just can't."
"It was your idea in the first place," Polgara reminded her.
"I was wrong. Wrong. I should have stayed in Riva."
"No. You have done something that none of the rest of us could have. You have guaranteed us the errands. I'm not even sure that Geryon could have done that."
"But they're all going to die."
"Now where did you get that idea?"
"The Angrax are going to outnumber us at least 2-1. They'll butcher my army."
"Who told you that?"
I listened,"
Tenedra replied, fumbling with the amulet at her throat.
"I heard what Rotha, Anheg, and the others said when they heard about the southern Murkos."
"I see," Polgara said gravely.
"We are going to throw away our lives. Nothing could save us. And just now I even found a way to bring the serfs into it. Their lives are so miserable that they'll follow me just for a chance to eat regularly. And I will do it, Lady Polgara. If I think I might need them, I will deliberately take them from their homes and lead them to death. I can't help myself."
Polgara took a glass from a nearby table and emptied a small glass vial into it.
"The war is not over yet, Tenedra. It has not even begun."
She swirled the dark amber liquid around in the bottom of the glass.
"I have seen hopeless wars won before. If you give in to despair before you begin, you will have no chance at all. Rodar's a very clever tactician, you know, and the men in your army are very brave. We won't commit to any battle until we absolutely have to, and if Geryon can reach Torak in time, and if he wins, the Angarax will fall apart and we won't have to fight them at all. Here,"
she held out the glass,
"drink this."
Numbly, Tenedra took the glass and drank. The amber liquid was bitter, and it left a strange, fiery aftertaste in her mouth.
"It all depends on Geryon, then."
"It has always depended on him, dear."
Tenedra sighed.
"I wish,"
she began, then faltered to a stop.
"Wish what, dear?"
"Oh, Lady Polgara, I never once told Geryon that I love him. I would give anything to be able to tell him that, just once."
"He knows, Tenedra."
"But that's not the same."
Tenedra sighed again. A strange lassitude had begun to creep over her, and she had stopped crying. It was difficult, somehow, even to remember why she had been weeping. She suddenly felt eyes on her, and turned. Eren sat quietly in the corner, watching her. His deep blue eyes were filled with sympathy, and, oddly, with hope. And then Polgara took the princess in her arms and began rocking slowly back and forth, humming a soothing kind of melody. Without knowing when it happened, Tenedra fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. The attempt on her life came the following morning. Her army was marching south from Vauxhall, passing through the sunlit forest along the Great West Road. The princess was riding at the head of the column, talking with Barak and Mandorallan, when an arrow, buzzing spitefully, came out of the trees. It was the buzz that gave Barak an instant of warning.
"Look out!"
he shouted, suddenly covering Tenedra with his great shield. The arrow shattered against it, and Barak, cursing horribly, drew his sword. Bran's youngest son, Ulban, however, was already plunging at a dead run into the forest. His face had gone deathly pale, and his sword seemed to leap into his hands as he spun his horse. The sound of the galloping mount faded back among the trees. After several moments, there was a dreadful scream. Shouts of alarm came from the army behind them, and a confused babble of voices. Polgara rode forward, her face white.
"I am all right, Lady Polgara,"
Tinedra assured her quickly.
"Barak saved me."
"What happened?" Polgara demanded.
"Someone shot an arrow at her. If I hadn't heard it buzz, it might have been very bad."
Valdoran had picked up the shattered arrow shaft and was looking at it closely.
"The fletching is loose," he said,
rubbing his finger over the feathers.
"That's what made it buzz like that."
Ulban came riding back out of the forest, his bloody sword still in his hand.
"Is the queen safe?"
he demanded. For some reason his voice seemed on the verge of hysteria.
"She's fine,"
Barak said, looking at him curiously.
"Who was it?"
"A Murgo, I think. He had scars on his cheeks."
"Did you kill him?"
Ulban nodded.
"Are you sure you're all right, my queen?"
he asked Tinedra. His pale blonde hair was tousled, and he seemed very young and very earnest.
"I'm just fine, Ulban,"
she replied.
"You were very brave. But you should have waited instead of riding off alone like that. There might have been more than one."
"Then I would have killed them all," Ulban declared fiercely. "I will destroy anyone who even raises a finger against you." The young man was actually trembling with rage.
"Bad dedication becomes the young Ulban,"
Mandarallan told him.
"I think we had better put out some scouts,"
Barak suggested to King Rodar.
"At least until we get out of these trees. Khorodulin was going to chase all of the Murgos out of Arendia, but it looks as if he missed a few."
"Let me lead the scouting parties,"
Ulban begged.
"Your son has a great deal of enthusiasm," Rodar observed to Brand. "I like that in a young man."
He turned back to Ulban.
"All right. Take as many men as you need. I don't want any Murgos within 5 miles of the princess."
"You have my word on it," Ulban declared, wheeling his horse and plunging back into the forest. They rode a bit more cautiously after that, and archers were placed strategically to watch the crowd when Tinedra spoke. Ulban rather grimly reported that a few more Murgos had been flushed out of the trees ahead of them, but there were no further incidents. It was very nearly the first day of summer when they rode out of the forest onto the central Arendish plain. Tinedra, by that time, had gathered nearly every able-bodied Astorian into her army, and her hosts spread out behind her in a sea of humanity as she led the way out onto the plain. The sky above was very blue as they left the trees behind, and the grass was very green beneath the hooves of their horses.
"And where now, Your Majesty?"
Mandarallan inquired.
"To Vomembre,"
Tinedra replied.
"I will speak to the Membrate knights, and then we will go on to Tolnedra."
"I hope your father still loves you, Tinedra. It will take a lot of love to make Ranborun forgive you for entering Tolnedra with this army at your back."
"He adores me,"
Tinedra assured him confidently. King Rodar still looked dubious. The army marched down through the plains of central Arendia toward the capital at Vomembre, where King Khorodulin had assembled the Membrate knights and their retainers. The weather continued fair, and they marched in bright sunshine. One sunny morning, shortly after they had set out, Lady Polgara rode forward and joined Tinedra at the head of the column.
"Have you decided how you are going to deal with your father yet?"
"I'm not sure. He is probably going to be extremely difficult."
"The Baroons usually are."
"I am a Baroon, Lady Polgara."
"I know."
Polgara looked penetratingly at the princess.
"You have grown considerably in the past few months, dear," she observed.
"I didn't really have much choice, Lady Polgara. Esau came on rather suddenly."
Tenedra giggled then, as a thought suddenly struck her.
Poor Garion,
she laughed.
Why, poor Garion? I was horrid to him, wasn't I?
Moderately horrid, yes.
How were any of you able to stand me?
We clenched our teeth frequently.
Do you think he will be proud of me? If he knows what I am doing, I mean?
Yes, I think he would be.
I'm going to make it all up to him, you know. I'm going to be the best wife in the world.
That's nice, dear.
I won't scold or shout or anything.
Don't make promises you can't keep, Tenedra,
Bulgara said wisely.
Well,
the little princess amended.
Almost never, anyway.
Bulgara smiled.
We'll see.
The Mimbrate knights were encamped on the great plain before the city of Vomimbre. Together with their men-at-arms, they comprised a formidable army, glittering in the sunlight.
Oh, dear!
Tenedra faltered as she stared down at the vast gathering from the hilltop where she and the Elorn kings had ridden to catch the glimpse of the city.
What's the problem? Rodar asked her.
There are so many of them.
That's the whole idea, isn't it?
A tall Mimbrate knight with dark hair and beard, wearing a black velvet surcoat over his polished armor, galloped up the hill and reined in some yards before them. He looked from face to face, then inclined his head in a polite bow. He turned to Mandorallan.
Greetings to the bastard of Volmandor from Coradulan, King of Orindia.
You still haven't gotten that straightened out, have you? Barak muttered to Mandorallan.
I have had not the leisure, my lord, Mandorallan replied.
He turned to the knight.
Hail and well met, Sir Andoric. I pray thee, convey our greetings to his majesty, and advise him that we come in peace, which he doubtless doth know already.
I will, Sir Mandorallan, Andoric responded. Who's your apple tree doing, Andoric?
Barak asked, grinning openly.
It doth flourish, my lord of Trelheim, Andoric answered proudly. My care for it has been most tender, and I have hopes of a bounteous harvest. I am confident that I have not disappointed Holy Belgrath.
He turned and clattered back down the hill, sounding his horn every 100 yards or so.
What was that all about?
King Anhig asked his red-bearded cousin with a puzzled frown.
We have been here before, Barak replied. Andoric didn't believe us when we told him who Belgroth was. Belgroth made an apple tree grow up out of the stones of the courtyard, and that sort of convinced him.
I pray thee, Mandorallan said then, his eyes clouded with a sudden pain. I see the approach of dear friends. I shall return presently.
He moved his horse at a canter toward a knight and a lady who were riding out from the city.
Good man there, Rodar mused, watching the great knight as he departed. But why do I get the feeling that when I'm talking to him, my words are bouncing off solid bone?
Mandorallan is my knight.
Tenedra quickly came to the defense of her champion.
He does not need to think. I will do his thinking for him.
She stopped suddenly.
Oh, dear. That sounds dreadful, doesn't it?
King Rodar laughed.
You are a treasure, Tenedra, he said fondly. But you do tend to blurt things out on occasion.
Who are those people?
Tenedra asked, curiously watching as Mandorallan rode to meet the couple who had emerged from the gates of Vomimbre.
That's the Baron of Oebor, Dernek replied quietly, and his wife, the Baroness Nirina. Mandorallan's in love with her.
What?
Oh, it's all very proper, Dernek assured her quickly. I didn't understand it at first myself. But I guess it's the sort of thing that happens here in Orindia. Oh, it's a tragedy, of course. All three of them are suffering terribly.
The good man sighed then.
Oh, dear,
Tenedra said, biting her lip.
I didn't know. And I've treated him so badly at times.
I'm sure he'll forgive you, princess, Dernek told her. He has a very great heart,
A short time later, King Coradulin rode out from the city, accompanied by Mandorallan and a score of armored knights. Tenedra had met the young king of Arindia several years before, and she remembered him as a pale, thin young man with a beautiful voice. On this occasion he was dressed in full armor and a crimson surcoat. He raised his visor as he approached.
"Ah, your majesty," he greeted her gravely. "We have awaited thy coming with great anticipation."
"Your majesty is too kind,"
Tenedra replied.
"We have marveled at the stories of thy mobilization of our Asturian cousins," the king told her. "Thine oratory must be wondrously persuasive to move them to lay aside their customary enmities."
"The day wears on, your majesty," King Rodar observed.
"Her majesty would like to address you, knights, with your permission, of course. Once you have heard her, I think you will understand her value to our cause."
"At once, your majesty," Coradulin agreed.
He turned to one of his men.
"Assemble the knights and the men-at-arms of Mimbre, that the Riven Queen may disclose her mind to them," he commanded.
The army, which had followed Tenedra down through the plains of Arindia, had begun to arrive and was flowing down onto the plain before the city in a vast multitude. Drawn up to meet that force stood the glittering Mimbret knights. The air crackled with suspicion as the two groups eyed each other.
"I think that we had better move right along," King Chohag suggested. "An accidental remark out there could precipitate some unpleasantness that we would all prefer to avoid."
Tenedra had already begun to feel sick to her stomach. The feeling by now, however, was so familiar that it no longer even worried her. A platform had been erected on a spot that stood midway between Tenedra's army and the armored knights of King Coradulin. The princess, accompanied by all of her friends and the Mimbrate honor guard, rode down to the platform where she nervously dismounted.
"Feel free to speak at length, Tenedra," Lady Polgara quietly advised. "Mimbrates dote on ceremony, and they are as patient as stones if you give them something formal to watch. It is about 2 hours until sunset. Try to climax the speech to coincide with that."
Tenedra gasped.
2 hours?
"If you need longer, we could build bonfires," Durnick offered helpfully.
2 hours ought to be about right, Lady Polgara surmised.
Tenedra quickly began mentally revising her speech.
"You will make sure that they can all hear me?"
she asked Polgara.
"I'll take care of it, dear."
Tenedra drew in a deep breath.
"All right, then. Here we go."
And she was helped up onto the platform. It was not pleasant. It never was. But her weeks of practice in northern Arindia had given her the ability to assess the mood of a crowd and to adjust the pace of her delivery accordingly. As Polgara had suggested, the Mimbrates seemed quite willing to listen interminably. Moreover, standing here on the field at Vomimbre gave her words a certain dramatic impact. Torak himself had stood here, and the vast human sea of the Angorak hordes had hurled themselves from here against the unyielding walls of the city gleaming at the edge of the plain. Tenedra spoke, the words rolling from her mouth as she delivered her impassioned address. Every eye was upon her, and every ear was bent to her words. Whatever sorcery Lady Polgara used to make the Riven Queen's voice audible at the farthest edge of the crowd was clearly working. Tenedra could see the impact of what she was saying rippling through the hosts before her like a breeze touching a field of bending wheat. And then, as the sun hovered in a golden cloud just above the western horizon, the little queen moved into the climatic crescendo of her oration. The words pride, honor, courage, and duty sang in the blood of her rapt listeners. Her final question,
"Who will follow me?"
was delivered just as the setting sun bathed the field with flaming light, and was answered with an ear-splitting roar,
as the Mimbrate knights drew their swords in salute. Perspiring heavily in her sun-heated armor, Tenedra, as was her custom, drew her own sword in reply, leaped to her horse, and led her now enormous army from the field.
"Stupendous!"
she heard King Coradulan marvel as he rode behind her.
"Now you see why we follow her," King Anheg told him. "She is magnificent," King Coradulan declared. "Truly, my lords, such eloquence can only be a gift from the gods. I had viewed our enterprise with some trepidation, I confess it, but gladly would I challenge all the hosts of Angarak now. Heaven itself is with this marvelous child, and we cannot fail."
"I will feel better after I see how the legions respond to her," King Rodar observed. "They are a pretty hard-bitten lot, and I think it might take a bit more than a speech about patriotism to move them."
Tenedra, however, had already begun to work on that. She considered the problem from every angle as she sat alone in her tent that evening, brushing her hair. She needed something to stir her countrymen, and she instinctively knew what it must be. Quite suddenly, the silver amulet at her throat gave a strange little quiver, something it had never done before. Tenedra laid down her brush and touched her fingertips to the talisman.
"I know you can hear me, father," she heard Polgara say.
A sudden image rose in Tenedra's mind of Polgara wrapped in her blue cloak, standing atop a hill with the night breeze stirring her hair.
"Have you regained your temper yet?"
Belgarath's voice sounded wary.
"We will talk about that some other time. What are you up to?"
"At the moment, I'm up to my ears in drunk Nadrax. We're in a tavern in Yar Nadrak."
"I might have guessed. Is Garion all right?"
"And of course he is. I'm not going to let anything happen to him, Paul. Where are you?"
"At Vomembre. We have raised the errands, and we are going on to Tol Nedra in the morning."
"Oh, well, Ranbarun won't like that very much."
"We have a certain advantage. Tenedra is leading the army."
"Tenedra?"
Belgarath sounded startled.
"It seems that she was what the passage in the Codex meant. She has been preaching the errands out of the trees as if she owned them."
"What an amazing thing."
"Did you know that the southern Murgos are already gathered at Rakoska?"
"I've heard some rumors."
"It changes things, you know."
Perhaps. Who's in charge of the army?"
"Rodar."
"Good. Tell him to avoid anything major as long as possible, Paul. But keep the Angarax off my back."
"We'll do what we can."
She seemed to hesitate for a moment.
"Are you all right, father?" she asked carefully. The question seemed important for some reason.
"Do you mean, am I still in full possession of my faculties?"
He sounded amused.
"Garion told me that you were worried about that."
"I told him not to say anything."
"By the time he got around to it, the whole question was pretty much academic."
"Are you... I mean, can you still..."
"Everything seems to work the same as always, Paul."
"Give my love to Garion."
"Of course. Don't make a habit of this, but keep in touch with me."
"Very well, father."
The amulet under Senedra's fingers quivered again. Then Polgara's voice spoke quite firmly.
"All right, Senedra," the sorceress said. "You can stop eavesdropping now."
Guiltily, Tenedra jerked her fingers from the amulet. The next morning, even before the sun came up, she sent for Barak and Durnik.
"I'm going to need every scrap of Angarak gold in the entire army," she announced to them. "Every single coin. Buy it from the men if you have to, but get me all of the red gold you can lay your hands on."
"I don't suppose that you would care to tell us why,"
Barak said sourly. The big man was surly about being pulled from his bed before daylight.
"I am a Tol Nedran," she informed him, "and I know my countrymen. I think I am going to need some bait."
Chapter 27 Ranborun the 23rd, Emperor of Tolnedra, was livid with rage. Tinedra noticed with a certain pang that her father had aged considerably in the year that she had been absent, and she wished that their meeting might be more cordial than this one promised to be. The emperor had drawn up his legions on the plains of northern Tolnedra, and they faced Tinedra's army as it emerged from the forest of Vordu. The sun was warm, and the crimson standards of the legions, rising from what seemed to be a vast sea of brightly burnished steel, waved imposingly in the summer breeze. The massed legions had taken up positions along the crest of a line of low hills, and they looked down at Tinedra's sprawling army with the tactical advantage of terrain in their favor. King Rodar quietly pointed this out to the young queen as they dismounted to meet the emperor.
"We definitely don't want to provoke anything here," he advised her. "Try your best to be polite, at least."
"I know what I'm doing, Your Majesty," she replied airily, removing her helmet and carefully smoothing her hair.
"Tinedra," Rodar said bluntly, taking her arm in a firm grasp. "You have been playing this on your veins since the first day we landed on the Hook of Orindia. You don't know from one minute to the next what you're going to do. I most definitely do not propose to attack the Tolnedran legions uphill, so be civil to your father, or I will take you over my knee and spank you. Do you understand me?"
"Rodar,"
Tinedra gasped.
"What a terrible thing to say."
"I mean every word. You mind your manners, young lady."
"Of course I will,"
she promised. She gave him a sly little girl look through fluttering eyelashes.
"Do you still love me, Rodar?"
she asked in a tiny voice. He gave her a helpless look, and then she patted his broad cheek.
"Everything will be just fine then,"
she assured him.
"Here comes my father."
"Tinedra," Ranborun demanded angrily, striding to meet them. "Just exactly what do you think you're doing?"
The emperor was dressed in gold-embossed armor, and Tinedra thought he looked rather silly in it.
"I am just passing through, father,"
she replied as inoffensively as possible.
"You have been well, I trust?"
"I was, until you violated my borders. Where did you get this army?"
"Here and there, father,"
she shrugged.
"We really ought to talk, you know, someplace private."
"I don't have anything to say to you,"
the bald-headed little man declared.
"I refuse to talk to you until you get this army off of Tolnedran soil."
"Oh, father,"
she reprimanded him,
"stop being so childish."
"Childish?"
the emperor exploded.
"Childish?" "Your Majesty perhaps chose the wrong word,"
King Rodar interposed, giving Tinedra a hard look.
"As we all know, she tends at times to be a trifle undiplomatic." "What are you doing here, Rodar?"
Ranborun demanded. He looked around quickly at the other kings.
"Why have the Alons invaded Tinedra?"
"We have not invaded you, Ranborun,"
Anheg told him.
"If we had, the smoke from burning towns and villages would be rising behind us. You know how we make war."
"What are you doing here, then?"
King Kohag answered in a calm voice.
"As Her Majesty advised you, we are only passing through on our way to the east."
"And exactly what do you plan to do in the east?"
"That is our business," Unheg told him bluntly.
"Try to be civil," Lady Polgara said to the Kerak king. She turned to the emperor. "My father and I explained to you what was happening last summer, Ranborun. Were you not listening?"
"That was before you stole my daughter," he retorted. "What have you done to her? She was difficult before, but now she is absolutely impossible."
"Children grow up, Your Majesty," Baldera replied philosophically. The queen's point was well taken, however. We do need to talk, preferably in private.
What queen are we talking about?
The Emperor asked bitingly.
I don't see any queen here.
Tenedra's eyes hardened. Father, you know what's happening. Now stop playing games and talk sense. This is very important.
Your Highness knows me well enough to know that I do not play games,
he told her in an icy tone.
Your Majesty?
She corrected him.
Your Highness,
he insisted.
Your Majesty,
she repeated, her voice going up an octave.
Your Highness,
he snarled from between clenched teeth.
Do we really need to squabble like bad-tempered children right in front of the armies?
Polgara asked calmly.
She's right, you know,
Rodar said to Ranbarun.
We're all beginning to look a bit foolish out here. We ought to try to maintain the fiction of dignity, at least.
The Emperor glanced involuntarily over one shoulder at the glittering ranks of his legions, drawn up on the hilltops not far away.
Very well,
he conceded grudgingly.
But I want it clearly understood that the only thing we're going to talk about is your withdrawal from Tonedran soil. If you will follow me, we will go to my pavilion.
Which stands right in the middle of your legions, King Anheg added.
Forgive me, Ranbarun, but we are not that stupid. Why don't we go to my pavilion instead?
I am no stupider than you are, Anheg,
the Emperor retorted.
If I may, King Thorek said mildly, in the interests of expediency, might we not assume that this spot is more or less neutral?
He turned to Brindig.
Colonel, would you be so good as to have a large tent erected here?
At once, Your Majesty, the sober-faced Brindig replied. King Rodar grinned.
As you can see, the legendary practicality of the Sindars is not a myth.
The Emperor looked a bit sour, but finally seemed to remember his manners.
I have not seen you in a long time, Thorak. I hope that Layla is well.
She sends her regards,
the King of Sindaria replied politely.
You've got good sense, Thorak,
the Emperor burst out.
Why have you lent yourself to this insane adventure?
I think that might be one of the things we ought to discuss in private, don't you?
Polgara suggested smoothly.
How is the squabble over the succession going?
Rodar asked in a tone of a man making small talk.
It is still up in the air,
Ranbarun responded, also in a neutral manner.
The Hornets seem to be joining forces, though.
That's unfortunate,
Rodar murmured.
The Hornets have a bad reputation.
Under Colonel Brendig's direction, a squad of Sindarian soldiers were quickly erecting a large, bright-colored pavilion on the green turf not far away.
Did you deal with Duke Kador, Father?
Tenedra inquired.
His Grace found his life burdensome,
Ranbarun replied with a short laugh.
Someone rather carelessly left some poison lying about in his prison cell, and he sampled it extensively. We gave him a splendid funeral.
Tenedra smiled.
I'm so sorry that I missed it.
The pavilion's ready now, King Thorak told them. Shall we go inside?
They all entered and sat at the table the soldiers had placed inside. Lord Morin, the Emperor's chamberlain, held Tenedra's chair for her.
How has he been?
Tenedra whispered to the brown-mantled official.
Not well, princess,
Morin replied.
Your absence grieved him more than he cared to admit.
Is he eating well? And getting his rest?
We try, Highness, Morin shrugged. But your father's not the easiest person in the world to get along with.
Do you have his medicine?
Naturally, Highness. I never go anywhere without it. Suppose we get down to business,
Rodar was saying. Taurugus has sealed his western border.
and the southern Murgos have moved into position around Ragoska. Zakath, the Malorian emperor, has set up a staging area on the plains outside of Tulselek to receive his troops as he ferries them in. We are running out of time, Ranborun.
I am negotiating with Taurgas, the emperor replied, and I will dispatch a plenipotentiary to Zakath immediately. I am certain this can be settled without a war.
You can talk to Taurgas until your tongue falls out, Anheg snorted. And Zakath probably doesn't even know or care who you are. As soon as they have gathered their forces, they will march. This war cannot be avoided, and I for one am just as happy about that. Let us exterminate the Angrax once and for all.
Isn't that just a bit uncivilized, Anheg?
Ranborun asked him.
Your Imperial Majesty, King Corodulan said formally. The King of Kharak speaks hastily, perhaps, but there is a wisdom in his words. Must we live forever, under the threat of invasion from the east? Might it not be best forever to quell them?
All of this is very interesting, Tenedra interrupted them coolly, but it is really beside the point. The actual point at issue here is that the Raven King has returned, and Tolnedra is required by the provisions of the Accords of Omembre to submit to his leadership.
Perhaps, her father replied. But young Belgarion seems to be absent. Have you misplaced him somewhere? Or is it perhaps that he still had pots to scrub in the scullery at Riva, so that you had to leave him behind?
That is beneath you, father, Tenedra said scornfully. The Overlord of the West requires your service. Are you going to shame the Baruns and Tenedra by abrogating the accords?
Oh, no, daughter, he said, holding up one hand. Tenedra always meticulously observes every clause of every treaty she has ever signed. The Accords require me to submit to Belgarion, and I will do precisely that, just as soon as he comes here and tells me that he wants me to.
I am acting in his stead, Tenedra announced.
I don't seem to recall anything that states that the authority is transferable.
I am the Raven Queen, Tenedra retorted hotly. And I have been invested with co-rulership by Belgarion himself.
The wedding must have been very private. I am a little hurt that I was not invited.
The wedding will take place in due time, father. In the meantime, I speak for Belgarion and for Eva.
Speak all you want, girl. I am not obliged to listen, however.
At the moment, you are only the betrothed of the Riven King. You are not his wife, and therefore not his queen.
If we want to be strictly legal about it, until such time as you do marry, you are still under my authority. Perhaps if you apologize and get out of that stupid-looking armor and put on proper clothing, I will forgive you. Otherwise, I will be forced to punish you.
Punish? Punish?
Don't scream at me, Zenedra, the emperor said hotly.
Things seem to be deteriorating rapidly, Beric observed dryly to Anheg. I noticed that, Anheg agreed.
I am the Riven Queen,
Zenedra shouted at her father now.
You are a silly girl, he shot back at her.
That does it, father, she declared, leaping to her feet. You would deliver command of your legions to me at once, and then you will return to Tolhanath, where your servants can wrap you in shawls and feed you gruel, since you are obviously too senile to be of any further use to me.
Senile? The emperor roared at her, also jumping up. Get out of my sight! Take your stinking Elon army out of Tenedra at once, or I will order my legions to throw you out!
Sinedra, however, was already storming toward the door of the tent.
"You come back here," he raged at her. "I have not finished talking to you yet."
"Yes, you have, father,"
she shouted back.
"Now I am going to talk. Barak, I need that sack you have tied to your saddle."
She rushed from the tent and climbed onto her horse, spluttering with apparent fury.
"Are you sure that you know what you are doing?"
Barak asked her as he tied the sack of Angarak coins to her saddle.
"Perfectly,"
she replied in a calm voice. Barak's eyes narrowed as he looked at her.
"You seem to have regained your temper in a remarkably short time."
"I never lost it, Barak."
"You were acting in there?"
"Obviously. Well, at least partially. It will take my father an hour or so to regain his composure, and by then it will be too late. Tell Rodar and the others to prepare the army to march. The legions will be joining us."
"What makes you think that?"
"I'm going to fetch them, right now."
She turned to Mandaralan, who had just emerged from the tent.
"Where have you been?"
she asked.
"Come along, I need an escort."
"Where are we going, Pry?"
the knight asked.
"You'll see,"
she told him, and she turned her mount and rode at a trot up the hillside toward the massed legions. Mandaralan exchanged a helpless look with Barak, and then clanged into his saddle to follow. Sinedra, riding ahead, carefully put her fingertips to her amulet.
"Lady Pogra,"
she whispered,
"can you hear me?"
She was not certain that the amulet would work that way, but she had to try.
"Lady Pogra,"
she whispered again, a bit more urgently.
"What are you doing, Sinedra?"
Pogra's voice sounded quite clearly in the little queen's ears.
"I'm going to talk to the legions,"
Sinedra answered.
"Can you fix it so they will hear me? All of them?"
"Yes, but the legions won't be much interested in a speech about patriotism."
"I've got a different one,"
Sinedra assured her.
"Your father is having a fit in here. He's actually foaming at the mouth."
Sinedra sighed regretfully.
"I know. Happens fairly often. Lord Morin has the medicine with him. Please try to keep him from biting his tongue."
"You goaded him into this deliberately, didn't you, Sinedra?"
"I needed time to talk to the legions,"
the princess replied.
"The fit won't really hurt him very much. He's had fits all of his life. He'll have a nosebleed and a terrible headache when it's over. Please take care of him, Lady Pogra. I do love him, you know."
"I'll see what I can do, but you and I are going to have a long talk about this, young lady. There are some things you just don't do."
"I didn't have any choice, Lady Pogra. This is for Garion. Please, do what you have to do so that the legions can hear me. It is awfully important."
"All right, Sinedra, but don't do anything foolish." And then the voice was gone. Sinedra quickly scanned the standards drawn up before her, selected the familiar emblem of the 83rd Legion, and rode toward it. It was necessary that she place herself in front of men who would recognize her and confirm her identity to the rest of her father's army. The 83rd was primarily a ceremonial unit, and by tradition its barracks were inside the imperial compound at Tol Hanath. It was a select group, still limited to the traditional 1,000 men, and it served primarily as a palace guard. Sinedra knew every man in the 83rd by sight, and most of them by name. Confidently, she approached them.
"Colonel Albor,"
she said courteously, greeting the commander of the 83rd, a stout man with a florid face and a touch of gray at his temples.
"Your Highness," the colonel replied with a respectful inclination of his head, "we have missed you at the palace."
Sinedra knew that to be a lie. The duty of guarding her person had been one of the common stakes in Barak's dice games, with the honor always going to the loser.
"I need a small favor, Colonel,"
she said to him as winsomely as she could.
"If it is in my power, Highness," he answered, hedging a bit.
"I wish to address my father's legions,"
she explained,
"and I want them to know who I am."
She smiled at him, warmly, insincerely. Albor was a Horbite,
and Senedra privately detested him.
"Since the 83rd practically raised me," she continued, "you of all people should recognize me and be able to identify me."
"That is true, Your Highness," Albor admitted.
"Do you suppose you could send runners to the other legions to inform them just who I am?"
"At once, Your Highness," Albor agreed.
He obviously saw nothing dangerous in her request. For a moment, Zinedra almost felt sorry for him. The runners, trotters, actually, since members of the 83rd were not very athletic, began to circulate through the massed legions. Zinedra chatted the while with Colonel Albor and his officers, though she kept a watchful eye on the tent where her father was recuperating from his seizure, and also on the gold-colored canopy beneath which the Tolnedran general staff was assembled. She definitely did not want some curious officer riding over to ask what she was doing. Finally, when she judged that any further delay might be dangerous, she politely excused herself. She turned her horse and, with Mandorolan close behind her, she rode back out to a spot where she was certain she could be seen.
"Sound your horn, Mandorolan,"
she told her knight.
"We are some distance from our own forces, Your Majesty. I pray thee, be moderate in thine address. Even I might experience some difficulty in facing the massed legions of old Tornedra."
She smiled at him.
"You know you can trust me, Mandorolan?"
"With my life, Your Majesty," he replied, and lifted his horn to his lips.
As his last ringing notes faded, Zinedra, her stomach churning with the now familiar nausea, rose in her stirrups to speak.
"Legionnaires,"
she called to them,
"I am Princess Zinedra, the daughter of your emperor."
It was not perhaps the best beginning in the world, but she had to start somewhere, and this was going to be something in the nature of a performance rather than an oration, so a bit of awkwardness in places wouldn't hurt anything.
"I have come to set your minds at rest," she continued. "The army massed before you comes in peace. This fair green field, this sacred Tolnedran soil, shall not be a battleground this day. For today, at least, no legionnaire will shed his blood in defense of the empire."
A ripple of relief passed through the massed legions. No matter how professional soldiers might be, an avoided battle was always good news. Zinedra drew in a deep, quivering breath. It needed just a little twist now, something to lead logically to what she really wanted to say.
"Today, you will not be called upon to die for your brass half-crown."
The brass half-crown was the legionnaire's standard daily pay.
"I cannot, however, speak for tomorrow. No one can say when the affairs of the empire will demand that you lay down your lives. It may be tomorrow that the interests of some powerful merchant may need legion blood for protection."
She lifted her hands in a rueful little gesture.
"But then, that is the way it has always been, hasn't it? The legions die for brass, so that others might have gold."
A cynical laugh of agreement greeted that remark. Zinedra had heard enough of the idle talk of her father's soldiers to know that this complaint was at the core of every legionnaire's view of the world. Blood and gold. Our blood for their gold. It was very nearly a legion motto. They were almost with her now. The quivering in her stomach subsided a bit, and her voice became stronger. She told them a story then. A story she had heard in a half-dozen versions since her childhood. It was the story of a good legionnaire who did his duty and saved his money. His wife had suffered through the hardships and separations that went with being married to a legionnaire. When he was mustered out of his legion, they had gone home and bought a little shop, and all the years of sacrifice seemed worthwhile.
"And then one day, his wife became very ill,"
Zinedra continued her story.
"And the physician's fee was very high."
She had been carefully untying the sack fastened to her saddle while she spoke.
"The physician demanded this much," she said,
taking 3 blood-red Murgle coins from the sack and holding them up for all to see.
"And the legionnaire went to a powerful merchant and borrowed the money to pay the physician. But the physician, like most of them, was a fraud, and the legionnaire's money might as well have been thrown away."
Quite casually, Tsenedra tossed the gold coins into the high grass behind her.
"The soldier's good and faithful wife died, and when the legionnaire was bowed down with grief, the powerful merchant came to him and said, 'Where is the money I lent to you?'"
She took out 3 more coins and held them up.
"Where is that good red gold I gave you to pay the physician?"
But the legionnaire had no gold, she told them.
"His hands were empty."
She spread her fingers, letting the gold coins fall to the ground.
"And so, the merchant took the legionnaire's shop to pay the debt. A rich man grew richer. And what happened to the legionnaire? Well, he still had his sword. He had been a good soldier, so he had kept it bright and sharp. And after his wife's funeral, he took his sword and went out into a field not far from the town. And he fell upon it. And that's how the story ends."
She had them now. She could see it in their faces. The story she had told them had been around for a long time. But the gold coins she had so casually tossed away gave it an entirely new emphasis. She took out several of the Angorak coins and looked at them curiously, as if seeing them for the first time.
"Why do you suppose that all of the gold we see these days is red?"
she asked them.
"I always thought gold was supposed to be yellow. Where does all of this red gold come from?"
"From Solmergos,"
several of them answered her.
"Really?"
She looked at the coins with an apparent distaste.
"What is Murgo gold doing in Tolnedra?"
And she threw the coins away. The iron discipline of the legions wavered, and they all took an involuntary step forward.
"Of course I don't suppose an ordinary soldier sees much red gold. Why should a Murgo try to bribe a common soldier when he can bribe the officers? Or the powerful men who decide where and when the legions are to go to bleed and die?"
She took out another coin and looked at it.
"Do you know, I think that every single one of these is from Solmergos."
She said it negligently, throwing the coin away.
"Do you suppose that the Murgos are trying to buy up Tolnedra?"
There was an angry mutter at that.
"There must be a great deal of this red gold lying about in the Angorak kingdoms, if that's what they have in mind, wouldn't you say? I have heard stories about that, though. Don't they say that the mines of Tholmurgos are bottomless, and that there are rivers in Garognadrak that look like streams of blood, because the gravel over which they flow is pure gold? Why, gold must be as cheap as dirt in the lands of the east."
She took out another coin, glanced at it, then tossed it away. The legions took another involuntary step forward. The officers barked the command to stand fast. But they also looked hungrily toward the tall grass where the princess had been so indifferently throwing the red gold coins.
"It may be that the army I am leading will be able to find out just how much gold lies on the ground in the lands of the Angoraks,"
Tsenedra confided to them.
"The Murgos and the Grolums have been practicing this same kind of deceit in Arindia and Sindaria and the Elorn kingdoms. We are on our way to chastise them for it."
She stopped, as if an idea had just occurred to her.
"There is always room in an army for a few more good soldiers," she mused thoughtfully. "I know that most legionnaires serve out of loyalty to their legions and love for Tolnedra. But there may be a few among you who are not satisfied with 1 brass half-crown a day. I am sure such men would be welcome in my army.
She took another red coin out of her dwindling supply.
Would you believe that there's another Murgle gold piece?
She demanded, and let the coin drop from her fingers. A sound went through the massed legions that was almost a groan. The princess sighed then.
I forgot something,
she said regretfully.
My army is leaving at once, and it takes weeks for a legionnaire to arrange for leave, doesn't it?
Who needs a leave? Someone shouted.
You wouldn't actually desert your legions, would you?
She asked them incredulously.
The princess offers gold, another man roared. Let Ranborun keep his brass.
Tsinedra dipped one last time into the bag and took out the last few coins.
Would you actually follow me?
She asked in her most little girl voice.
Just for this?
And she let the coins trickle out of her hand. The emperor's general staff at that point made a fatal mistake. They dispatched a platoon of cavalry to take the princess into custody. Seeing mounted men riding toward the ground Tsinedra had so liberally strewn with gold and mistaking their intent, the legions broke. Officers were swarmed under and trampled as Ranbarun's army lunged forward to scramble in the grass for the coins.
I pray thee, your majesty, Mandarallan urged, drawing his sword. Let us withdraw to safety.
In a moment, Sir Mandarallan,
Tsinedra replied, quite calmly. She stared directly at the desperately greedy legionnaires running toward her.
My army marches immediately,
she announced.
If the Imperial Legions wish to join us, I welcome them.
And with that she wheeled her horse and galloped back toward her own forces with Mandarallan at her side. Behind her she heard the heavy tread of thousands of feet. Someone among the massed legions began to chant, and it was a chant that soon spread.
Tsinedra! 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 They shouted,
and their heavy steps marked time to the chant. The Princess Tsinedra, her sun-touched hair streaming in the wind behind her, galloped on, leading the mass mutiny of the legions. Even as she rode, Tsinedra knew that her every word had been a deception. There would be no more wealth for these legionnaires than there would be glory or easy victory for the Erinns that she had gathered from the forests of Asturia and the plains of Mimbre. She had raised an army to lead into a hopeless war. It was for love of Geryon, however, and perhaps for even more. If the prophecy that so controlled their destinies demanded this of her, there was no way she could have refused. Despite all of the anguish that lay ahead, she would have done this and more. For the first time, Tsinedra accepted the fact that she no longer controlled her own destiny. Something infinitely more powerful than she commanded her, and she must obey. Polgara and Belgarath, with lives spanning aeons, could perhaps devote themselves to an idea, a concept. But Tsinedra was barely 16 years old, and she needed something more human to arouse her devotion. At this very moment, somewhere in the forests of Garagnadrak, there was a sandy-haired young man with a serious face whose safety, whose very life, depended on every effort that she could muster. The princess surrendered, finally, to love. She swore to herself that she would never fail her Geryon. If this army were not enough, she would raise another, at whatever cost. Tsinedra sighed, then squared her shoulders and led the Tolnedran legions across the sunny fields to swell the ranks of her army. Here ends Book 4 of the Belgariad. Book 5, Enchanter's Endgame, brings this epic to a brilliant conclusion as Belgarion confronts evil Torak to decide the fate of men, gods, and prophecies. This concludes Castle of Wizardry, Book 4 of the Belgariad by David Eddings. This novel is a work of fiction, names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or have been used fictitiously. Any resemblance to any actual events, locales, or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. From Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly. Thanks for listening.